Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us this morning. We're also pleased to have back on this program a friend of ours who occasionally stops by and we talk about insects. The guest, May Barenbaum. She's professor of entomology at University of Illinois. In fact, she is head of the Department of Entomology. She's a scientist who specializes in studying insects. And what we do when she's here is we encourage you to call in with questions about the insects that you have seen, the great variety in the insect world, how they go about living their lives. The one thing that we say, please save for another day, are extermination questions. We have an entomologist who specializes in that very thing. Phil Nixon is here occasionally and to try to help people deal with insect pests in the home and the garden. Although, I think also Phil is pretty good about saying, well, now, first of all, you have to decide, can you live with this? If you can, well, that's okay. If not, we'll help you out. But this is a completely different sort of thing. So save your extermination questions. But this is the show that we encourage you to engage your curiosity and appreciate insects for the many varied ways they go about living their lives. So that's what we're up to here this morning. The number, if you have a question, is 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana, folks. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. In addition to teaching here at the University of Illinois, May is the author of several books. I'll just mention a few titles. 99 Gnats, Nits, and Nibblers, followed by 99 More Maggots, Mites, and Munchers. Other books include Bugs in the System, Insects and Their Impact on Human Affairs, and Buzzwords. I think that's the most recent one, a collection of columns that she wrote. Buzzwords, A Scientist Muses on Sex, Bugs, and Rock and Roll. And all of these are available in paper and are very accessible to people who are not entomologists. So if you're interested in insects, and if you have kids who are, they might like the 99 books. So you can go out and look for those. And I imagine they're all probably available in a bookstore in this community.
I hope so.
I hope so? Okay. Well, welcome back.
Always great to be here.
One thing I have noticed, it seems that during the time that now it's been warm enough, because it, of course, sort of goes back and forth, but warm enough to have my windows open, nighttime has been really quiet. And I'm thinking, well, is that really usual for this time of year, or should there be more insect singing going on at night? And is it that I really am noticing that, gosh, it seems to be awfully quiet out there?
And I think it might be still a little bit early for the traditional summer singers, not too many spring singers. Right. A lot of sort of late summer, mid and late summer singing, the cicadas are, well, unless it's periodical cicadas, but that's only every 13 or 17 years. Let's see, in this area, well, at least in the Sangamon area, it was 85, and then 13 plus 85 is 98, so we're not due for another decade or so. But then they sing in May. They're really, then you'd notice, then you'd have to shut your window.
Okay, well, I guess then it's just that it's too early for them to be singing. And I was just thinking, well, I wonder if there's anything odd about this particular year, particularly that
Silent
it's been
spring,
dry.
Yeah.
Silent spring, yeah. So, okay. So that's not the case. Has the fact, though, that it has generally, at least until recently, been pretty dry, has that had an impact on the insect world?
Probably had a beneficial impact on the insect world, although it's very hard to generalize with a million species because for every insect that dry conditions favor, there's probably one that's really miserable about dry conditions. But the thing about when it's dry, one of the major mortality factors that insects have to contend with is fungal diseases, pathogens. There's some really remarkable insect pathogens that basically sprout mushrooms out of the mouths of flies and have them adhere to stems, and there are all kinds of strange growths and things. And fungus needs sort of humid conditions. So one tends to see fungal plagues among the insects in wet years, but not in dry years. But for every insect where dry conditions are a good thing, there's probably one or two for whom dry conditions are horrible. So.
Okay. Mm,
aquatic insects, you know. Insects that breed in temporary pools are probably not very happy, but most people are probably happy that they're not happy because a lot of those are mosquitoes.
Yes, yes, indeed. Okay, well, we have somebody here on a car phone, so we'll get right to them. Line four, hello.
Yeah, hi. I find entomology a fascinating subject, and I'm not from this area, from the Southwest, and I noticed that in some of the southern parts of the state, the lightning bugs are out, and I'm curious what their purpose is and why they only come out at certain parts of the year. And I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Okay.
That's a really nice segue, actually, because lightning bugs tend to be more abundant in moist, wet years because what they're about. But when they're in their immature stages, a lot of them tend to eat slugs, and slugs like moist conditions. Around here, we don't really get them till June, early July. There's always a good show around the 4th of July, you know, if you ignore the fireworks. And that flashing business they do is a courtship ritual where the males and females exchange these light signals. It's one way to find each other at night. And they generate this light with chemical energy rather than electrical energy, unlike the way we generate light. It's very efficient. You know, if you were burning a light bulb at the end of your butt for long periods of time, it would get very hot. And this was one of the big advantages of firefly chemical-generated light, is that it's cold light, not hot light. So, now, people have often speculated on why other organisms aren't so, you know, don't use this cool signaling system for finding each other at night. And apparently one reason fireflies can get away with this is that they're distasteful. I mean, they're easy to spot. They're easy to catch. If you've been a kid and you go around and grab fireflies, they don't put up much of a struggle. They're kind of soft-bodied. Well, if you were to eat one, you would really regret it because they make steroidal compounds that are defensive in nature. They're called leucobufagins, and they are really nasty. And in fact, there have been some incidents in veterinary medicine where people have tried to feed their gecko or other lizard-like pet insects they collect themselves instead of going out to the, you know, pet store to get mealworms. And you shouldn't give geckos fireflies. If there's, you know, first rule of gecko raising is don't give them fireflies. Even if you can catch them, don't give them because they are poisonous.
All right. So the idea is there then some creature, if you eat insects, you eat one of these fireflies, and if you survive, you'd say to yourself, well, I'm never going to eat one of those things again. So that's why fireflies can manage to do that, flying around at night, shining this light, and manage to survive.
Yeah, most things in nature, if they're conspicuously advertising themselves, then they have a reason for this supreme self-confidence. They probably don't taste very good.
I guess isn't that also true, or I'm sure we've talked about this, of insects that are very brightly colored?
Absolutely. Yeah, the bright colors are, you know, if you taste bad, then you want to make sure everybody notices you and remembers what you look like, particularly if they've had a bad experience. So if you're ever, you know, say you're on the Survivor 3 and you're stuck in, you know, the African veldt or something, don't eat, like, brightly colored insects. Stay away from the ladybugs. Ladybugs tend to be poisonous. A lot of butterflies are poisonous. That's one of the reasons they can sort of flit around poetically and not, you know, fly that fast and not hide or blend in with the bark when they rest on trees. It's because they don't taste good.
All right. So already we've learned two things this morning. One, don't feed fireflies to your gecko. And the other one is don't eat the brightly colored insects. May Barenbaum is our guest this morning. She's head of the Department of Entomology at University of Illinois, and every once in a while is here. And we do this kind of show where we talk about the insect world. No extermination questions, please, but otherwise, anything else is welcome. 333-WILL or 9455, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Next caller is in Trelease Woods on here, line number one. Where is Trelease Woods?
Oh, you're talking to me?
Yeah.
Hi, Trelease Woods is northwest of Urbana, and I think May knows who she's talking to.
Well, I hope so.
All right.
It's a university-owned property, so I...
I see.
I'm doing research on the woods out here, the forest bud break in the spring, and the warbler migration and caterpillar populations. And May is one of my committee members. That's right. I have a question about the how this particular spring might have affected the caterpillar populations.
You mean the weather we've had?
Yeah, it just seems to have been quite an odd spring.
It is incredibly odd because we haven't had consistent warm weather or cold weather or consistent dry weather or wet weather. So
right.
The caterpillars that we've been following for years, we can't even generalize about what the impact of spring will be on these guys because their first appearance in the field was earlier than usual, yet their phenology, their developmental period is so spread out that even though some of them are just about ready to pupate, we're still finding in some little pockets of populations early stages. So this, I think, is an anything-goes spring.
And it's my first field season.
Yeah, it's nice when at least the weather, if we're going to have a natural disaster, you know, like a prolonged period of drought, then you can speak with confidence. But when your drought is interrupted by torrential rainfall, then it's anybody's guess. Although, you know, one thing, well, as long as you're in Trelease, I don't know if you've noticed the maple petiole borer effects out there.
Oh yeah, sure.
This is a very interesting insect that is only sort of
sawfly larvae.
Yeah, that's right. It's a larva of a sawfly, sort of a caterpillar-like creature that lives inside the petiole, the attachment, where the leaf attaches to the twig. It lives inside that little part of the leaf and bores it out so that the maple leaf falls onto the ground. So all over town, I guess in Effingham County, there have been problems. There's these sort of carpets of maple leaves.
Mm-hmm.
And this is kind of, I haven't seen it before in Trelease, but I guess it's happened on a few other occasions. It's one of these frustrating things where there's nothing you can do about it by the time you find out about it. The sawfly is actually not on the forest floor with the leaves. It's still back in what's left of the petiole on the tree.
Right.
But very interesting things going on out at Trelease Woods, including your thesis research.
Right. Well, thanks, May.
Sure.
All right, thanks for the call. Let's go to Clinton, Indiana, for somebody else right here, line 4.
Good morning.
Yes.
I'd like to talk about a household bug that I'm living with, and I don't know who he is. He's about 3/8 to a half an inch long and only about 1/8 of an inch wide. It's basically charcoal in color, but there's a band in the middle that is a lighter gray and with a little bit of brown in it. He's a very poor flyer, and he frequently lands upside down.
We know it's not a cat because they always land on their feet. But it sounds a bit like a carpet beetle. Can you tell if it's a little bit fuzzy or hairy? Not long hair, but just sort of fuzzy.
Maybe he is. I didn't think about that. He's not exactly really slick like a beetle.
Right. He's not shiny, right?
No.
Right. So I think that's consistent. If you got him under a microscope, if you were so inclined, you might see some very fine hairs. What it sounds like to me is a carpet beetle. And carpet beetles collectively are, they're in the family Dermestidae. This is a group called the skin or hide beetles. And they, in sort of their ancient past, before humans were around, how they made their living was by eating dead things, like the wool or hair or skin of dead things.
Mm-hmm.
And in houses, there's lots of wool, hair, and skin of dead things that we call furniture and carpets and rugs and the like. So,
I tend to see him in wet places around the sinks. Is that because he needs some water occasionally?
Well, that wouldn't be a carpet beetle because they're pretty good at dry things. So it's, again, it's 3/8, you said, of an inch or so?
Yeah. He's long and thin.
Okay.
Not too long, you know, 3/8 to a half inch.
Well, that little gray stripe is still consistent. I haven't seen them in sinks, though.
That's because he can't get himself turned over the sink.
Well, and that is consistent. One thing, you know, the carpet beetles are not like the world's most graceful flyers. I mean, think about it. If you're what you're hunting down is carrion, you don't need to be, you know, really good at chasing your prey, you know, through all kinds of complex aerobatics. So, aerobatics. That would probably be my best guess. If are there a lot of them or?
Oh, I usually find one or two a day, and I found some of them occasionally in my pantry cabinets, kitchen cabinets where you store things.
Well, again, that would not be inconsistent to have them in hidden places. That's kind of where they're typically found. And you're pretty sure it's a beetle then. It's not a fly with soft wings or
no.
anything. Yeah. Mm-mm. Well, it does sound like a distinct possibility would be a carpet beetle.
Carpet beetle. Well, I thank you very much for your help. I've been wondering about him all year.
Well, yeah, I hope you don't have an infestation, you know, a carpet that's being anything woolen. Do you have woolen?
Most of my carpet is man-made fibers. I do have a new wool rug, but I haven't seen him around that in the family room. It's one of those braided rugs in wool.
If it were around, it'd be most likely in a low traffic area. So maybe you just have somebody who maybe is showing up in your sink because he can't find anything decent to eat in the house.
I hope so. Thank you very much.
Well, good luck.
Thanks. Is it possible to say what percentage of the insect kingdom has as its job recycling? Essentially?
What percentage? That's an interesting question.
It seems like that's what a lot of insects do.
Well, you know, what I always say, it's a dirty job, but somebody's got to do it.
Yeah, yeah.
And not like the mammals are stepping up to the plate, you know. Although there are a few carrion-feeding mammals, but...
Yeah, you got your vultures and
those are birds.
Stuff. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry.
Not enough
that's
legs,
right.
I know. I'm not good at them either. Right. So, but yeah, I mean, you know, I think wolves will eat carrion. A lot of the canids will eat carrion, but not with the single-mindedness of purpose that so many insects eat carrion and dung and other refuse.
Yeah. Okay. And let's go on to next is Urbana, line number two.
Hi there.
Hi.
I was on a Cub Scout camp out last weekend. We went to Forest Glen.
Yes, with Stuart Burlocker, one of my colleagues,
that's
was
right.
on that very same camp out.
Yes. Well, we were hiking up a creek and came across a log that was across the creek. And I was just about to climb over it when I realized I was going to put my leg on something that looked like about a 3-inch long, very, very, very skinny wasp. It was shiny. It was black and yellow. And out of its back end, it had two very long things. I'm a little bit familiar with crickets, so I was guessing they were ovipositors.
You get an A for that one.
Well, they were like 4 or 5 inches long, big whip-like things, which I thought maybe she was trying to stick them in the bark.
Yep, you got it exactly right.
These it very awkwardly. I mean, this was really strange behavior.
These are, we can call them wood wasps in a sense. They're parasitic wasps. And what they do, they have these incredibly elongated ovipositors for sawing through the wood. And what their larvae do not eat wood. Their larvae eat grubs or caterpillars that eat wood. So these amazing wasps actually can feel the vibrations of the grubs tunneling through the trunk of a tree. And then they'll use these ovipositors, which look, you know, sort of like whip-like and skinny.
Mm-hmm.
They can actually pierce solid wood and then find 4 to 5 inches below the surface the, you know, little potential meal there.
Uh-huh.
And it's not like the grub has much it can do to defend itself. And they use these ovipositors, the ovipositor then to pierce the skin or integument of the caterpillar or grub, lay their eggs in there, and then the eggs of the wasp hatch and eat the innards of
the... So
the
ovipositor actually finds the grub. It's not the larva that have to seek out
nope,
the grub.
No, it's mom does all the work.
Wow.
And the kids...
Well, we were, you know, very disinclined to climb over that thing and disturb this huge bug that looked pretty wicked.
Well, I imagine that the bug would have been a little disturbed. You know, it can't be easy to saw your way through 4 inches of wood when you've got
right.
operating with those skinny little...
Would they have a powerful stinger? Or
No. The thing is, with the parasitic wasps, what we call a stinger is an ovipositor. And in the social wasps, in the social bee and the bees, the only one who lays the eggs is the queen, and the ovipositor then becomes a stinger for all the other workers in the colony. But these are solitary. They don't have any, you know, they don't have a queen to do all the work. Everybody lays her own eggs. And as a result, the ovipositor is an ovipositor. It doesn't have any sort of stinger-like properties.
So it wouldn't have stung us no matter what we'd done?
Not that I can imagine how, no, unless you had a four-inch block of wood in your hand or something.
And
yeah,
we treated it with a lot of respect.
Well, that's great, because I'm glad you avoided the knee-jerk reaction of slamming something heavy on anything that looks wasp-like.
So. No.
But
we also saw a beautiful rat snake, which we left undisturbed.
There's one of the, surprisingly enough, most popular films that used to be shown in Biology 104 was a short film about Megarissa, which is one of the ichneumonid wasps. It's got one of the longest ovipositor to body ratios of any, I think, of any insect. And this was just a short film. I don't even think it had narration. Demonstrating how this wasp manages to get, 6 or 7 inches through solid wood to find a grub lying there. And just, all right, maybe it's not Pearl Harbor or something, but it's still a pretty gripping film. So.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Next is a caller in Belgium here, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
As far as a carrion-eating mammal, if you call a marsupial a mammal, a possum eats a lot of carrion.
Absolutely.
They just love carrion.
In fact, one of the most disgusting moments in my undergraduate career.
I know what you're talking about.
Involved, I took mammalogy, and we had to dissect mammals, various mammals. And I had a rabbit assigned to me, but the guy across the table from me had a possum. And part of our assignment was to see what was in the stomach. And oh, gosh, it was disgusting. Among other things, there was sausage casing in there. I still remember to this day, it said, Parks, flavor makes it best, in this possum's stomach. So.
Yeah, one of my horrid examples of it is seeing one crawl out of the dead animal.
Ah.
Just creepy. But to get back to your first caller, first caller talked about fireflies. And one of the interesting things I've noticed about fireflies is you'll notice fireflies many times during the year, even earlier than what you spoke of, especially if it's hot. They never come out and start blinking until it's about 80 or 90 degrees. They seem to really enjoy the hot weather for blinking. Before that, they just kind of lay around and crawl around and do other things, I think.
Yeah, well, that's actually a very good observation. A lot of insects, insects are basically cold-blooded, so a lot of them depend on environmental temperature to get their body temperatures up to the point where their muscles work effectively. And, so there's some insects that you see flying around in very cold conditions or earlier than, during the day than most other insects. They actually have mechanisms for generating heat internally. But those that lack those mechanisms really are dependent on environmental temperatures to get them up and around. So.
If your previous caller just spoke of Forest Glen, take a very hot summer day in June or July and canoe the lower portion of the Big Vermilion River there, and you'll notice that the fireflies will be all the way across the river, and it just makes a tunnel of light that you can go through. Because on both sides of the river down there, there's lots of grassland, and fireflies like grasslands. But it happens to be right next to a river with a bunch of trees. It's the most amazing sight you'll ever see.
I have to admit, I'm pretty partial to fireflies, too. It's just the most amazing thing.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. Well,
one thing we don't have around here that I'd love to, I've never seen. I think there should be more insect tourism, personally, but like going down the Vermilion in June or July under the firefly arch. But in some parts of Tennessee, apparently, there are synchronous fireflies. There's some groups of fireflies that manage to fall into synchrony, so entire trees will blink in concert. These were originally described in I think Malaysia or somewhere in East Asia, and it was not known that there were any North American synchronous fireflies, but then these were discovered actually by an amateur, not by a professional entomologist, but by just a lady who happened to enjoy watching fireflies and realized that these things were falling into synchrony. So that, now there's a lot of professionals out there watching. But I think the potential for insect ecotourism has not been tapped here. In New Zealand, you can actually go through there are luminous, bioluminescent maggots that live in caves in New Zealand. And Waitomo is the name of the grotto. And you can take a boat, go through these grottos and watch the luminous, you know, bioluminescent maggots on the walls. So,
well, I was going to ask about other, we've talked about a little bit here about fireflies, about other insects that make light. Are there?
Well, the mycetophyllids, the maggots that are bioluminescent in the caves in New Zealand. There's also click beetles, and people know what click beetles are. It's the Eleuthera is a family of beetles that have a little flange between their thorax and abdomen that allows them an unusual form of escape behavior. If you put them on the ground, they'll basically slap that flange down and go flying into the air. Or if you hold them in your hand, you can actually hear them clicking and trying to escape. And there are some pretty spectacular click beetles. The biggest one in North America is called the eyed elater, and it's, how big is that, an inch and a half or something? It's a big beetle. But down in Central South America, there's one called Phrixothrix, which is sometimes called the railroad beetle because it has red and green and yellow lights. So, you know, it's like sort of an oncoming locomotive. It's got all kinds of flashing lights that are different colors. So it's not just that sort of greenish light that fireflies make. There's other colors of other bioluminescent colors that insects make.
And is that, does it have something to do with mating like it does with fireflies?
Now, you know, the molecular biology of Phrixothrix has been worked out, but I'm not sure the biological, ecological significance of the lights has been worked out. I know it's defensive, and just like fireflies, in a way it's advertising
it says, I'm bad, leave me alone.
I'm bad, yeah. Uh-huh.
Okay. We are a little bit past the midpoint here. Our guest is Mae Barenbaum. She's head of the Department of Entomology at University of Illinois. And every once in a while is here on the show. We talk about insects, no extermination questions, please, but otherwise, other questions about the great and almost endless variety that they have and the different wacky things that they do. That's the idea here. If you've seen some insect, maybe you can give us the best description that you can, and then she may be able to tell you what it is. And all of those questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. And we have toll-free line, good, anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Another Indiana person here, Crawfordsville, Indiana, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
My wife and I would like to know why butterflies flit. Why don't they make a beeline when they fly?
Well, actually, not all butterflies flit. It kind of depends on which butterfly you're talking about. But you're right. It's the sort of archetypal butterfly flight is that sort of aimless-looking kind of flittering around. One reason they may flit instead of zoom is that a lot of them are distasteful, so they don't have to hurry. Another reason is it depends on what sex you're looking at. Some butterfly flight is associated with a courtship behavior or a display. Male black swallowtails, for example, will fly to the tops of high, any sort of topographic structure, any topographic relief, and they basically play king of the hill. There's a male there, and other males will challenge his position, and he'll chase him away. So there are these short flights that are, you know, it's incredibly aggressive in from the perspective of the insect, but from the perspective of the viewer, it kind of looks poetic or something. It looks like a little dance, but they're actually, you know, fighting with you. It's like World Federation Wrestling or something, real wrestling federation. But than other types of courtship flight, the some of the sulfur butterflies, the yellow ones that litter the roadsides in August because they come out of the alfalfa. They'll do sort of an upward sort of spiraling courtship flight. That's associated with mating. Males are the ones, I mean, females will do a searching flight, sort of low-level flight, looking for plants to lay eggs on. But the sort of, and both sexes will go flitting to look for nectar sources. And it's hard, bees are much better at finding nectar sources, among other reasons. Honeybees communicate with each other and they know exactly where to go because their nest mate has told them where to find it. So you can make a beeline if you're a bee because you have a roadmap. But the butterflies are kind of more or less on their own to try to find where the next nectar source is.
Thank you very much. We feel instructed.
Well, right. Probably more than you wanted to know about why butterflies fly the way they do.
It makes me think of fairly recently in my yard, I saw some butterflies doing what I thought probably was a courtship sort of thing. That it was, there were quite a number of them. There might have been 8 or 10.
Did they have white sort of bands and sort of reddish patches?
No, they seemed to be sort of a medium-sized butterfly. It was hard to get a good look at them because they move fast. And I think that they were sort of black and orange.
Yeah, these are, yeah, interesting. I think we're describing the same butterfly because these are everywhere right now, red admirals. And they like land on the ground and kind of circle around and land on the ground again.
Yeah, and these small numbers of them, maybe 2 or 3, would fly, and it would almost look like they were caught in a tornado.
Yeah.
They would sort of fly around each other, and then they would go off, and then other ones would...
Male territoriality again.
So those were all males?
These are macho butterflies. And, you know, the funny thing is these guys will... I mean, I've seen them sort of try to defend their territory against an oncoming car. You know, they'll fly in the middle of the road and sit there going... I was here first, you know. I don't know how adaptive that is, but it's for some reason an incredibly good year for red admirals, and right. They are everywhere, and they're doing exactly what you described right now.
Very good, red admirals. I'll have to note that down. It's a wonder that there are males on this planet. You know, it just
some of the things they do makes you wonder.
Let's talk with somebody in Savoy. I have a caller here on line one, and I'm actually not sure where they are. Is there a caller there on line one?
Hello, I'm line 2 in Savoy.
Oh, you're line 2. Oh, okay. Well, fine. Go ahead.
Good morning.
Hi.
Good morning. I saw an unusual insect in my backyard. I was wondering if it was a real insect or if it was a modified insect. It was about the size of a gnat, and it was flying, and it had a huge tuft of fuzziness on it. And I wasn't able to capture it, but I watched it, and I saw it legs, and it was, of course, flying, but I couldn't imagine if it had natural fibers growing out of it, white fibers, or if it had somehow had gotten some fibers stuck to it.
Now, this is, what end of the insect were the fuzziness?
Oh, on its back.
On its back.
Yeah.
Huh. Okay. And were these sort of more or less... even in length, or was it a big dust bunny kind of thing?
I don't think they were very even. It was more like a dust bunny. I'm not quite sure what you mean, but
it was sort of like a clump rather than
a clump.
Yeah. Huh. Well, there are some hairy gnat-like creatures, but they tend to have like cycoted. Flies look a bit hairy, but they're not gnat-like. They're more moth-like, actually, the little tiny flies.
Well, maybe a gnat is too small. It was quite noticeable. I thought it was some type of tree seed flying through the air, but it hovered for a moment, and I watched it, and I thought to grab it, and I showed it to my fiance, and she saw it, and I just let it drift away.
Did you notice how many wings, 2, 4?
I didn't notice. Mm-hmm. If there were, well, there obviously were wings. I did make sure it was a bug.
6 legs, right?
Yeah, it was flying. And
when you held it, were the wings sort of roof-like over the body?
I never did grab it.
Oh, you never, okay.
It was very tiny and fragile, so I didn't grab it. But I couldn't see the wings. Mm-hmm. It's this tuft of white coming up.
Well, there are insects that carry fluff on their backs. But they tend to be wingless ones, and I'm not sure why it would be floating by. These are immature. They're called brown lacewings, and they have these special grappling hooks on their back, and they decorate themselves with debris so that, you know, they can move in amongst their prey without detection. They'll even actually take fuzzy wax filaments off the backs of woolly aphids and stick it on their backs so they can crawl in like wolf in sheep's clothing and go pick off the woolly aphids because they look like a woolly aphid. Others are, you know, will carry bits of lichen or other. I mean, they really do look like walking bits of fluff, but they're walking bits of fluff, not flying bits of fluff. So that's an interesting observation. I can't imagine this was one was picked up by the. It wasn't very windy, was it?
No, it wasn't. It was a very still evening.
Yeah, that was. Well, I would have guessed cycoded, but they don't. They have pretty even hairiness and not clumpy hairiness. So,
okay. How do you spell that? In case I see one again, I'll study it a little bit closer.
Okay, the cycoded or the brown lacewing?
Either.
Oh, okay. Well, brown lacewing is brown lacewing or hemorrhoid, but you don't need to know that. And cycoded is, they're called moth flies. I guess that's easier.
Moth flies.
Yeah, and it's because their wings actually aren't hairy; they're more scaly. But they look kind of like fuzz. But I wouldn't call them gnat-like because they're not skinny like gnats. They're kind of small, but they're built in along more chunky lines.
So. Okay, so the brown lacewing that only pertain to the larva, right?
Right. The adults don't decorate themselves with with debris. Right. So.
Cycoda is spelled
P-S-Y-C-H-O-D-I-D, cycoded.
Oh.
As in psycho.
Got it. Okay. Well, I'll certainly gently capture one the next time.
Oh, great. Well, I'd be interested to see if you can figure out what it is.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next person is in Urbana, line 2. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have a question about a flying critter that was in my backyard last week, feeding off columbines, as in sipping nectar, and flitting about, acting like a hummingbird. And I thought it was a hummingbird, but really when I took a better look at it, it looked like a moth, a big moth with a striped body.
Right. And these are called hummingbird hawk moths, and they're in the family Sphingidae, and there's a bunch of them, and they all share that hovering behavior with hummingbirds. They're about actually the size of hummingbirds.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And probably the most common one around here, which has stripes, is the tobacco hornworm, Manduca sexa, which in its other life is like a 4-inch long green striped caterpillar green caterpillar with white stripes that eats tomatoes in your garden. So, but there are lots of other species. There's a species that grows up on catalpa trees around here that also has stripes on it, and they're really very attractive moths. And there are certain plants, in fact, that are pollinated exclusively by hummingbird hawk moths, not by hummingbirds, not by any other kind of insect. And there was one very famous case Darwin mentioned, you know, Charles Darwin, the founder of evolutionary biology. There was an orchid that had an 11-inch spur on it. You know how your columbine has that long sort of backward projecting part? Well, imagine that 11 inches long.
Mm-hmm.
And Darwin said somewhere there's a moth with an 11-inch tongue. And years later, decades later, people were investigating this plant, and that's in Malaysia, or Madagascar, Anagrasium. And sure enough, they found a sphingid moth, a hummingbird hawk moth, with an 11-inch tongue that, in fact, is the pollinator for that flower. And the name they gave it was Xanthopan morgani, which isn't very interesting, but the variety name they gave it was Predicta, because it was predicted by Darwin. So your columbines are perfect for the hawk moths, because they have that nice long spur for their nice long tongue to go into. And very few other insects can reach where the nectar is, because you have to have a long tongue to do it.
Right. So now should I watch my tomatoes for hornworms?
Well, you know, there are a lot of different hawk moths, but if it was sort of a brownish What color was it? Sort of
brownish with a white stripe.
Yeah, well, that's consistent with tobacco hornworm. So if you have tomatoes out there, mm-hmm. I'd keep an eye open.
I do. I will. Okay, thanks.
Sure.
All right, thanks. So why didn't they call it Darwinia predicta?
Well,
no, that's...
Yeah, you know, it's pretty... Why they made it the variety name and not the specific name, I don't know. But hey, you know, those entomologists, what can you do?
Well, there probably is something named after some...
Oh, yeah, there's a genus, Darwinia.
Oh,
yeah.
There is, okay.
A flower, yeah.
Oh, so maybe they thought, well, we don't want to confuse things. All right. Palestine, next caller here, line number 4. Hello?
Yes, curiosity. I noticed the other day I was putting ammonia on the field at night, and insects fly around a light. Do they bump into each other, and why not?
Oh, unquestionably.
I'm on a cell phone. I've got a lead.
All right. Well, thanks for the call.
Yeah. The question is, do insects who fly around lights bump into each other all the time? Insects fly into lights for reasons that are kind of beyond their control. At least that's what the operative hypothesis is that many nocturnal insects rely on celestial cues for navigation. So they're used to seeing distant point sources of light, and they'll orient their flight with relation to these distant point sources. Well, nature doesn't make any nearby point sources of light. I mean, distant point sources of light are like stars and the moon and things. Well, we humans came along whenever it was, when fire, I guess, was discovered. Made these small point sources of light that are nearby. And what happens is an insect that's hardwired to make certain adjustments relative to a distant point source makes those same adjustments to a close-by source and ends up spiraling in closer and closer. So a lot of them are just sort of drawn, well, like moth to a flame. They just probably think they're heading somewhere else and end up, you know, bumping into the light, frying themselves, bumping into each other. Now, not all insects are just helpless pawns responding to environmental stimuli they can't possibly understand. A lot of predaceous insects apparently have learned to respond to these nearby point sources, or at least have been selected to respond to them because they're great places for fast food, I guess, or fine dining, because they're all these confused and disoriented prey species bumping into each other. So you'll see if a lot of insects, a lot of predaceous insects hanging out at lights along with the moths and June beetles and other species that just seem to end up there by accident.
Very good. Other questions are welcome. We have about 5 or 6 minutes left. Our guest is Mae Barenbaum. She's head of the Department of Entomology at the University of Illinois. And if you have an insect question, it's as long as it's not extermination, you can give us a call, 333-9455, and also toll-free, 800-222-9455.
I can elaborate more on fireflies if people are interested. I mentioned this two-component system. There's an enzyme and a substrate, and the enzyme is called luciferase, and the gene for that enzyme has been identified and sequenced and cloned and actually put into other organisms because it's a nice that chemical light requires a cellular fuel called ATP. So many people who work with molecular biology use luciferase as a marker, a reporter gene. And it's just amazing to me that insect genes are now being put all kinds of places. My favorite final destination for luciferase, they put it in a glass catfish. Glass catfish are called glass catfish because they're transparent. So these guys light up. They basically made a, you know, like a neon tetra.
Did they do that?
Well, there were good scientific reasons, but I see the board is all illuminated, so maybe we can go to these questions.
Good scientific reasons, but we have someone here on a car phone, line number 4. Hello.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. A couple of different comments. About 6-7 years ago, we had a young woman from Japan at our house on July 4th, and the part of Japan she lived in didn't have fireflies. And as we were going out our front door that evening to go to the fireworks, she said, "Oh, is this part of the fireworks?" She was just amazed. She'd never seen anything like that coming out of the grass. And the other thing is we've had some beetles in our house in the past week. Beetles I've never seen in my house before. They're about an inch long. They have what looks like, and I haven't tested it too closely, little pincers on their head. The pincers go forward from their head. They're black. And I think they're the kind of beetles that make a funny clicking sound like you were talking about earlier if you mess with them. And we've had kind of a catch-and-release program putting them outside, but we've had probably a dozen of them in our house in the past week, and I'd never seen them before around the house. And we've lived in the house 10 years.
Well, those pinchers are, I mean, if they're the classic beetle with really conspicuous mandibles is called a stag beetle, and they're, I guess they're about an inch. I mean, the smaller species.
Yeah, that's what I've told my kids they were, but of course that was just mom's authority.
Sounds good to me, actually.
Are those common this year? Is it true that some years you have species of bugs that for some reason, you know the reasons, by some years there are certain species of bugs that are just phenomenally abundant, and then other years is there just normal numbers?
Absolutely. Well, we were saying earlier, red admirals are having a really good year, and I don't know that anybody knows why red admirals are having such a good year this year. So,
one year when I was a kid, the crickets were horribly common. All the buildings, on the outsides of the buildings from the ground up to about 2 feet above the ground were just covered with crickets.
Yeah, insects that are kind of cute in moderation get kind of sort of repellent when they're really numerous.
Yeah, sort of like deer and geese.
Yeah, right.
Okay, it was nice talking to you. Thanks.
Thanks for the call. We'll try to get at least one more here in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi, I have a question about spiders. We were hiking in the woods about a month ago, and we saw a spider web that had a bunch of little, we thought they were little eggs, but as the sun came out and shined on the web, all these tiny little spiders came out, and I don't know if I'd always thought that, I'm just curious on the life cycle of the spider and how they hatch, if they hatch in groups, or if that's really what we were seeing, or just some stuff about spiders and hatching and eggs and how they, their life cycle, beginning of their life cycle.
Most spiders that I know of do spin an egg sac, and then their little spiderlings will emerge en masse.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little, there's no chance those little droplets, there are two things those droplets could have been. Dew is one. And then the other thing is some spiders will put little adhesive gluey balls along their trap lines, the sticky lines of their web. And they would look sort of glisteny like that.
They did start to walk around. There were little teeny tiny little spiders.
Okay. Well, then
we didn't see any kind of egg casing or anything around the little spiders, so we didn't know if
it would. I don't know if any spiders that lay their eggs in a web, and so my guess is those were baby spiders that were dispersing, probably, rather than hatching, because a spider egg on a web would not have much of a chance. Webs are, a lot of spiders take their webs down every night. So.
Right.
And the sac really, it's just, great insulation, keeps them protected. And so as far as I know, most spiders will spin eggs in a sac. So.
Okay. Would they have already hatched maybe somewhere else?
Right.
And all come together?
And then maybe, or hatched from some central location and then sort of dispersed, so they're still in the same neighborhood. They haven't gone off to spin their own webs yet. Now, if you had been in Mexico, I would have suggested this is one of the very few species of social spiders that spin communal webs, but they don't do that here. There's just a handful of spiders that will cooperate and spin a massive, enormous collective web with, hundreds of individuals. But
what's the name of those?
That I'd have to look up. There's just a handful of them, and they're from Mexico and other parts south. So. But George Utz is the name of a guy who works on them, UETZ, if you want to look them up.
We're going to have to go because we're out of time. I'm sorry we have a caller we can't take. But probably at least one more time this summer, you can come back and we can
happy
do it
to.
Again. Mae Barenbaum is head of the Department of Entomology at U of I. Thanks very much.
Oh, my pleasure.